Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of October. A portrait of President Herbert Hoover this hour and tonight in documentary form on PBS. It's titled Landslide. It's directed by Chip Duncan from the Duncan Group, which is based here in Milwaukee, and produced by Chip and Tracy Dorsey. Both of those people are with us this hour. Chip is with us in our studios here in Milwaukee, and also Tracy. Chip joins us from time to time to talk about any number of his remarkable projects. He's been on a book tour for a good long time now with a remarkable book on Afghanistan, enough to go around. It's Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Darfur. We'll ask him to talk about that a little bit later, but we only have an hour to talk about a guy who's a pretty much forgotten figure in American history, no longer as a result of this documentary. Chip, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here, as always.
And very nice to have you here. Tracy, thank you so much for being with us as well.
My pleasure.
Yeah. So who would have thought that Herbert Hoover was an interesting guy? I haven't thought very much about Herbert Hoover, to tell you the truth.
I have to admit, I was shocked. He really is interesting.
He is interesting.
I mean, he for such a long time, he was kind of a one-note name in American history. It was like, well, the Great Depression and Herbert Hoover had become synonymous, and of course, all good Democrats out there probably just ran that into the ground as much as they could. And really, he's a fascinating figure. And wasn't, up until he was elected president, wasn't really a party guy. Part of the fascinating thing about his life is he looked at running for president as a Republican and then eventually as a Democrat. So,
right.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Man. Had you thought much about him, Tracy?
I hadn't really thought much about him at all before we started the documentary. When the project came in was people had always compared Bush to Herbert Hoover. And so I was, starting my research and thinking, well, how were they alike? And as I moved forward, it was actually, they weren't alike at all.
Mm-hmm.
Hoover was an amazing, very accomplished businessman, international traveler, self-made millionaire. His competency, as a presidential candidate, one of our interviewees, David Kennedy, had said that was his marked characteristic, his sheer unqualified competency as president.
Mm-hmm. I'm always amazed by people. My big guy is Abraham Lincoln. I love Abraham Lincoln. I read about him all the time, and I just got back from Springfield. I just think he was quite a guy. But I'm always struck by these people who come from absolutely nothing. I had no idea that Hoover was an orphan at the age of 10. He goes to live with his maternal uncle in Oregon. What a life, and then to later become president. Isn't that astounding?
He had so many things about his early childhood are interesting, and he was also raised as a Quaker. I think we've had two presidents who were raised as Quakers, Richard Nixon being the other. Yeah. But it certainly became a big part of his presidency and his belief system. He wrote about American individualism, which I'm sure you could trace right back to those roots as an orphan. He learned to essentially pull himself up by the bootstraps. So, a lot of what made him a great man are the same things that sort of brought him to his knees during the Depression, because he kept thinking we can rely on individualism, we can rely on volunteerism. And in fact, once the Great Depression happened, a lot of those things went out the window. But clearly a bootstraps kind of character.
Yeah. Talk more about this competency, because that runs through his life, until the Depression, when he got pretty much off track. But people thought of him as being able to accomplish the task, Tracy, no matter what it was, and he accomplished some huge things.
Well, even as president-elect, he gave an interview to a reporter and said that one of his biggest fears was that the American public had an idea of him as some sort of Superman, and if some unprecedented calamity were to befall the country, they would be disappointed because he wouldn't necessarily be able to solve it. And that, in fact, is what happened. But prior to taking office, he was a mining engineer. Amity Schles, another of our interviewees, compared him to the Bill Gates or Steve Jobs of his time. He knew how to make money out of seemingly nothing, to extract resources from the earth and all over the world. He traveled and worked in Australia, in China, in Russia, in South America. in London. I mean, he was a real international globetrotter.
Mm-hmm. And was also a real international humanitarian, Chip.
Well, he was. And his public service life really begins around 1914. He was living and working in London at the time that World War I broke out. So he became kind of a pivotal figure. And his professional life, which up to that point had really been as an entrepreneur, as a mining engineer, shifted. And it was interesting, little tidbits that you find out about later on about this man that are so incredible. When World War I broke out, there were about 100,000 Americans living or visiting in Europe at the time, and Hoover was the person that our administration looked to for help. He was a private citizen at the time, but he organized a relief effort first for Americans who were stranded by the war. One of the little things we found out that was interesting was when the war started, people stopped taking American Express traveler's checks. So they were literally stranded. I mean, they had no money, even though many of them may have been wealthy. But that's where his public service career started. And then after World War I, Wilson brought him in and said, we need your help. We've got to feed these people. And so Europe, you know, essentially was starving after World War I, and Hoover's credited with saving literally millions of lives. He's still to this day a huge hero in Belgium.
Isn't that something? And he does it by himself, his own resources. He gathers support.
His expertise, as we find later when he's back in the United States, is that he knew how to lead. He literally could galvanize people. Sometimes it was his own resources. Sometimes it was galvanizing other business leaders, other successful entrepreneurs together and saying, we need to do this. These people need to be fed. You know, I mean, he truly was the great humanitarian, credited with by Tim Walsh in our program, credited with starting what was he considered the first NGO, which is a non-governmental organization. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the questions then again become, well, what does he do when he's president? And that's a very different story.
Right. The other huge humanitarian effort, Tracy, is helping all the flood victims along the Mississippi River in what year was that, 24?
27.
Sorry.
Yeah. You know, in looking at that footage, it's fascinating to watch, especially as we were producing the documentary. It was not long after Katrina, and you know, it's been called the Katrina of the 20th century. Again, Tim Walsh, one of our interview subjects, says that I believe 900,000 people were victims of this flood. It was rainfall in the upper Mississippi, flooded vast areas of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arkansas. And Hoover was then Secretary of Commerce under Coolidge, but he goes down and appeals for charitable contributions. He organizes the National Guard to basically feed and house people for months as these floodwaters dissipate and people can get back on their feet.
And tell me, we were talking before the show about the footage, which is remarkable. I didn't know there was that much footage available from the 20s. The footage you have of the flood is quite striking and in pretty good shape.
Well, we found a copy of it. The library in West Branch, Iowa, the Hoover Presidential Library, had a copy, and we restored the copy. So it's really remarkable footage. And you know, it also speaks to Hoover that he was no slouch when it came to promotion. He had his own crew with him. I mean, he was...
Oh, did he really?
He brought his own crew, yeah. So a lot of the footage was shot by his own team. But it was preserved, and there were a couple of copies around, and I think, did a nice job of restoring it for the film. You know, what's interesting, though, is we tend a lot of times when we have conflicts or controversies today, we tend to think about how it's impacting us right now in the moment without looking at the history. And so when you look at the 27 flood, one of the things that's fascinating is that, first of all, the federal government, FEMA didn't exist. The federal government typically didn't respond to crises like a flood. And even though the river was transcending several states along the way and there were damages all the way from Iowa south to New Orleans, no, the federal government typically wouldn't respond to that. It was left up to local or state efforts. And it was so big that it really – it's disasters like that that beget the FEMAs of the world. So, you know, it grows out of it. And today we just – take it for granted that, oh, there's Medicare or, oh, there's a Highway Safety Commission or any number of things that didn't exist at the time of Hoover. In fact, he's responsible for creating many of the federal agencies that we have today.
Hmm. I was interested in Robert Reich's featured former Secretary of Labor in the film, and I was amazed when he said, again, it comes from this lack of knowledge on my part about Hoover and probably accepting the general myth that he didn't know what he was doing. He called him the best Commerce Secretary ever, probably. The best Commerce Secretary ever.
He did, and we went to Robert Reich for a lot of reasons. He's an expert on many things related to the economy, the Fed, the monetary policy, and he was ultimately, I think he was quite forgiving of Hoover, but specific to his role as Commerce Secretary, it was interesting to have Reich as a former Secretary of Labor commenting on him, and he did call him a remarkable Commerce Secretary. But Hoover, you know, came in at the time the federal budget, I believe, and Tracy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the federal budget was about $3 billion, which is less than the budget of the state of Wisconsin today. Mm-hmm. So the federal government wasn't the entity that usually got things done. But we were coming into a point in history where the federal government did need to start to standardize certain things. So Hoover started the Veterans Administration. He started the school lunch program. He standardized things like weights and measures. So, you know, today we take it for granted. We go to Ace Hardware, Home Depot, somewhere and buy a 2x4. And we take it for granted that it's actually a 2x4. Well, Hoover was credited with all kinds of things like that, that Reich is very complimentary of, and certainly he would know what it's like to run a major, you know, cabinet.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Hoover in that regard is that he was uniquely positioned in the history of America. He was the last of the old-fashioned administration and the first of really what is the 20th century new technology administrations, because we were in a technology boom in the 1920s when he was Secretary of Commerce.
Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile his being able to have the federal government involved in all the things that Chip just mentioned? Was there a change in philosophy so that he was very reluctant to have the federal government get involved in lifting people out of poverty, giving them jobs, realizing how awful the economic circumstances were for people after the stock market crash?
Well, Hoover's not black and white. It's not a question of he wants federal government out of all business. He just doesn't want federal government to impede on business. So he felt that the role was to help business operate more effectively. You know, he's an engineer. His mind works in making things more efficient, mm-hmm. and he thought that it was helpful to business as a whole to provide those standardizations and regulations that would help move business forward. But these were voluntary measures. These weren't, in many instances, he was more for associations, business associations, not government mandates.
Hmm. But he wasn't, because of what he did after World War I, he wasn't immune to human suffering. There seems to be an element where he just didn't see what was going on in this country.
Well, a number of our interview subjects comment on that. I think part of what the public bought into when Herbert Hoover was elected in 1928, what they saw was this great humanitarian. And, you know, obviously he was a great administrator, a great leader. He had crisis management skills. But when the market crash happened and when the Great Depression happened shortly after that, the willingness on his part to undertake humanitarian type work on behalf of the federal government wasn't there. So people suddenly felt like they had a scapegoat. This guy, you know, you're willing to feed 350 million Europeans after World War I. Where's our food? So it became a kind of a great conflict for many Americans in terms of how they perceived Hoover.
Mm-hmm. And I was really confused about that as we were doing our research. And ultimately, I think that it comes down to his philosophy of American individualism. He truly believed that Americans were different from all other peoples on Earth, and that part of the American core and spirit was our ability to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, just as he had done, and to be responsible for our communities and to take care of each other. So he really thought that neighborhoods and communities across the country would reach out to each other and take care of each other, but nobody had the resources.
Yeah, it was too much. I know that you didn't have, because it's an hour long, which seems like a long time until you try to get in a person's whole life, particularly as rich a life as Hoover's. You didn't get to spend a lot of time with his family. So I want you to fill in a little bit for us, because you do interview his great-granddaughter, who works for a news operation, I think, now, doesn't she? She worked for...
Margaret, yeah.
Yeah, Margaret. She's...
You'll see her occasionally as a contributor to Fox News.
Huh.
She's out speaking quite a bit, too. She's carrying the mantle of American individualism. So it was interesting because we wanted the family represented in the film, of course, and we had very good cooperation from the family. And as someone who does a lot of biographies, I can tell you that's a huge help. She's young, she's energetic, and she's terrific on television. Mm-hmm. And she is carrying kind of the ball for American individualism. But she also has a background in Republican politics and has worked in the Bush administration for a period of time as well.
Mm-hmm. And so, tell me more about his family. He had two sons, is that right?
He did. He had two sons. His wife, Lou Henry, interestingly, they both went to Stanford and they both had degrees in geology. So they had a number of things that brought them together professionally. And when he was traveling all over the world, she was with them, obviously. She did she was fairly in the background during most of his political career, but she actually did several remarkable things on her own, even as a first lady. She was the first lady to invite a spouse of an African-American into the White House for tea, which, you know, today seems like, you know, ancient history. But at the time, it was very controversial. Hmm. She came under a lot of criticism.
Hmm.
In terms of his ancestors, many are still around. And the Hoover family is still very vital and very much tied in with the Hoover Institution at Stanford today.
Hmm. Interesting. We're going to take some phone calls. We have a number of people who would like to speak with both of you. The documentary, A Portrait of President Herbert Hoover, will be tonight, a documentary on PBS titled Landslide, written and directed by Chip Duncan from the Duncan Group, which is based here in Milwaukee, and produced by Chip and Tracy Dorsey, who's joining us by phone from New York. Here's the number. We have one line open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we go to phone calls now for Chip and Tracy. Jack from Eagle River. Hello, Jack.
Yes, hello to you, too.
Hi.
I just wanted to add a comment or two about the Hoover Museum. Now, we were driving west on Route 80, and we remembered that the Hoover Museum was in West Branch, Iowa, where he came from, not far from Iowa City. And we thought, Herbert Hoover, you know, I grew up in a Democratic family in Chicago, and everything passed on to me was very negative about Hoover. We thought, well, we had extra time. If we didn't, we would have just driven by. So we went to the museum, and we were just absolutely amazed at the exhibits, the films, and as was pointed out, his inauguration speech could have been made this last January. I mean, it was uncanny, the parallel in a way. So I just thought I was going to encourage anyone, don't have our attitude about the museum, because we almost didn't go there, but it was well worthwhile. And I just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, thanks, Jack. Tracy?
Uh-huh.
Did you like the museum as well? It's a rich...
Well, the museum is really fascinating because what you do get is you get that early life, you get all of the relief efforts, you see how active Hoover was, not just before his presidency, but after his presidency, and so, yeah, I would say it's definitely worth seeing. What you don't get a lot of is his presidency.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Why wouldn't they have that in the museum?
They do touch on the Depression, but it's not a focus of the museum. It really is his life before and after the presidency.
Yeah. I don't know who said this in the documentary or if I read this somewhere else. Here was this guy considered, somebody said, perhaps the most highly regarded man in America before he's elected president, 4 years later considered the worst president in modern history. The worst president in modern history.
Well, that may be a Tim Egan soundbite. Tim is the author of a fascinating book on the Dust Bowl and a contributor to New York Times. He was probably our of all of our interview subjects the one who is the most critical to Hoover. I think that in that vein, one of the people we interviewed was Jonathan Alter, and he has a fascinating soundbite in the show that essentially says, you know, you can be as brilliant and as qualified as possible to be president, and that can still not be enough. He says it, of course, more eloquently than I just did. But I think that's one of the things that's so interesting about Hoover. Tremendously qualified. We've had and I think Kennedy says, the scholar from Stanford says in the show, that he may be the most qualified person we've ever had run for office.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the overlap. There's a little bit of footage on, because, of course, FDR had to deal with the same problems. The relationship, and particularly the day that FDR was inaugurated and that car ride, which, what's the truth behind that? I find that fascinating.
Well, the interesting thing was the interregnum, the period between the election and assuming office, was longer then. So it was actually March 4th, 1933, when FDR was inaugurated. So a longer period of time there, which was in many ways, I think we've realized you don't want it to be that long. You just want the new guy to take over, whoever he or she might be. And in the case of Hoover, a lot was still going on with the economy right up until that minute. And there was a bank crisis in Michigan that was taking place. I'll save the details for the show. But the bottom line is that Roosevelt was not willing to help Hoover at all. He said, look, you're the president up until I'm the president. So by the time the inauguration happened, there was no love lost between these two people. Hoover was very angry. Jonathan Alter does a great job of describing the ride, the car ride, down to the inauguration. And they didn't speak at all, and except for two words, lovely steel. And it was FDR commenting on the steel that they were using to build the Commerce Building. And that was it. But, of course, FDR was very lively, waving, happy, outgoing, charismatic. And Hoover just sat in the vehicle with a glum look on his face. And you know, we did the interviews before we saw the footage. And then, of course, the footage backs it up. It's amazing.
Yeah. And then Hoover kind of takes on the FDR administration. He becomes a critic, a fairly outspoken critic, Tracy.
He was extremely outspoken. I think he gave about a year where he didn't really speak up, but then he started doing radio shows. He started publishing, basically attacking the New Deal as fascist, and was vehemently against the programs that FDR was implementing as unconstitutional.
If I could add in, typically presidents over the course of history lay low after they've been president. So, for example, George W. Bush is laying low now. But what's interesting is if you look at today's politics, many of which mirror this period of time, Cheney being outspoken as a critic is very similar to the way Hoover was against FDR. And there are not a lot of historical precedents for that. We see Carter speak out occasionally. But for the most part, the president, once they've left office, they tend to lay low. And really, the parallel I see today is Cheney.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks very much, Jack, for the call. We go next to Rich from Rhinelander. Hey, Rich.
Hey, Kathleen. Before I ask my question, I have to ask your guest, did Smoot-Hawley, the Tariff Act, was that enacted under Hoover?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And its intent was to protect American jobs and business, right?
Well, it was a tariff on goods coming into the United States. It's actually considered by the people we interviewed on both what would be considered the left and the right, they pretty universally came down against it as maybe the worst mistake that Hoover made. And it was a tariff on foreign goods, and it tended to stifle our ability to export. More than 1,000 economists from around the country wrote him a letter saying, please don't do this, and he did it anyway.
Both Amity Schles and David Kennedy say in the documentary that Smoot-Hawley was one of the most awful moments of Hoover's political career and was responsible in part for extending the depth and the duration of the Depression.
Well, I'm interested in the concept of moral hazard. That is, if you rescue someone who engages in risky behavior, you're going to encourage the same behavior in the future. And I, I know relatively little about Herbert Hoover, except you've said he was a Quaker and he believed in self-reliance and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. But something doesn't jibe here, because during the Great Depression, innocent people lost their jobs. Their jobs had been taken from them by really risk-loving financiers. And I don't think we bailed out the financial community the way we've tried to do it this time. And I'm wondering if you have any viewpoints about, if you take a job from somebody and you ship it overseas, would Herbert Hoover see any need to say, something's terribly wrong here? It isn't even consistent with someone like Henry Ford, who believed, you know, people have to have jobs so that they can become consumers of the products they make. What would Hoover say about our current situation, I guess, is what I'm asking. I'm asking you to be seers into Hoover's mind.
I think the situations are on one hand very similar, on another very, very different. So he would have probably been a protectionist in a way that neither Bush nor Obama have been. But it was such a different world then. You know, when the market crashed, only 2% of Americans had money in the market. So, you know, that's a pretty phenomenal statistic. Most of the rural banks did not have money in the market. So the banking system was very different than it is today. They weren't – the banks, for example, in your community in Rhinelander or here in Milwaukee, a lot of times are either owned by or share an interest with a much greater financial institution. But that wasn't the case then. I think where there might be similarities is, I think across the board, everybody would be fighting for jobs. At the time, the statistics are phenomenal. The unemployment rate by the time he left office was 25%. And that's 25% of most households, because at the time, most women were not working outside of the home. And so it's a very different statistic. And hopefully we're not headed that direction.
Yeah, you're right. Thanks very much for the call. Tell us about – I found this one of the most disturbing parts of the film, as I'm sure that many will, the Bonus Army March on Washington. And I just wasn't aware of MacArthur being brought in and Patton being brought in to disperse these people and burn their homes or their tents. What a story that is.
Well, after World War One, veterans were given a bonus, but the bonus wasn't to be paid. Actually, Tracy, I don't remember when the bonus was due. It was around 1940, wasn't it?
1945, yeah.
And so the bonus that they were given by the federal government, when the Depression hit, when unemployment hit, they all said, we want our bonus now. We want our bonus sooner. Now, there were two issues. One was the bonus loan, where Congress passed and Hoover vetoed, and then they overrode the veto to allow veterans to borrow against their bonus. But that wasn't enough. And so in 1932, in May of 32, not long before the election, over 20,000 veterans marched on Washington. And it's really startling when you see the footage and you see what happened. Because they marched on Washington, they appealed to Congress for their bonus. They were basically saying, give it to us, 10, 12, 15 years early. And Congress, of course, was at that point more sympathetic to the bonus marchers. But Hoover sent in troops. So you had veterans converging on Washington, D.C., camping out for a long period of time, and Hoover sent in troops. And MacArthur, Eisenhower, and Patton were all three, at that point, officers in the military that burned the encampments and threw the troops out of Washington.
Of veterans. Burned the encampment of veterans.
The footage is truly remarkable because in addition to, the army on horseback and many tanks rolling through the streets of Washington to attack veterans. It's still obviously very controversial, and the decisions behind it are also controversial. Many historians, and including in our documentary, Kennedy and Nash and Schles, all say that MacArthur exceeded his orders, that Hoover didn't want them burned out. MacArthur exceeded his orders. Though later on the campaign trail, Hoover did boast that his administration knew how to take care of a mob.
But the interesting thing is that they called it a mob, too. The whole idea shifted that suddenly 20,000 veterans were now considered a mob. Mm-hmm. And this is the same guy that created the Veterans Administration. Mm-hmm. So there's a real disconnect, and you see a disconnect several times in Hoover's presidency. But this one, a lot of people will say, you know, this may have been the crowning blow for the election that followed because, of course, the Democrats and FDR immediately launched into, you know, criticism of this event. But, there, I mean, people died. This was the footage is amazing. But imagine today if Veterans March – I mean, we have the Million Man March, and relatively speaking, it's a peaceful, orderly thing. Yes. But not the bonus march.
What was the response, Tracy, among the public? People must have been absolutely outraged.
Well, I think that, and Amity Schles talks about this, that that it was perceived that Hoover didn't care at all, that he had just turned a cold shoulder and had no compassion for these veterans. And this was the kind of prevailing feeling as the Depression wore on, that Hoover just didn't care and people couldn't understand it. But, you know, there wasn't the kind of polling that we have now. There wasn't the kind of give and take and immediate response mechanisms for the general public. So Hoover wasn't aware until well into the campaign how much of the American public he had lost. He thought that, according to Tim Walsh, he thought that the American public would support him because he had been the great humanitarian and he had done so much for the country, that they would just stick with him and he deserved a second term.
Mm-hmm. He also, the point is made, was off base because of polling, or was there something more to this that he was going to win again?
Oh, he definitely thought that he had a chance to win. And it's ironic. We chose the term landslide as our title because Hoover won in a landslide and then loses in a landslide in 1932. But you know, I worked on a film with a company called Staymates Communications on Iowa Public TV. We did a film on Henry Wallace. And Wallace was frequently when he would go out – this is 1948 – when he would go out and do his public speeches, he'd get pelted with tomatoes. And in Wallace's case, he understood he was an underdog and he understood that it was, you know, unlikely that he would win. But with Hoover, it was really the point at which the public would show up and throw rotten tomatoes or, you know, boo or hiss, that he suddenly realized that he was not popular. And for Hoover, this was a big blow. I mean, this man's ego had to be enormous by this point because his whole life he had been an extraordinarily successful person up until 1932.
Let's go next to Pete from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Pete.
Hey there. Hey, my question, you guys seem a little critical of Hoover, and I'm just wondering what you think after researching this, what do you think he should have done differently regarding the Depression?
All right, there's a good question.
Well, it's interesting. First, your observation that we sound critical. Most people that have seen the film are taking the other viewpoint, so I guess you never know if you're doing it right until people see it, but most people are amazed at Hoover's great successes up to the Depression. If I continue to follow the line of telling you not so much what we think, but rather what our interview subjects think, I would say that Robert Reich would be the example from our show who would have – he would have increased spending. He would have done stimulus. And you noted during the Bush administration and now continued into Obama, the thing that the federal government is doing – to try and deal with the recession now and the Depression, then FDR started stimulus policies. Having said that, it was 1928 to 1932, and most people didn't really understand that stimulus might be an answer to
it. Didn't government expenditures expand greatly, though, under Hoover? I thought that he had the biggest federal budget up until at that point, a record of all time. So I thought they did increase greatly.
As a matter of fact, you're right. They did increase significantly under Hoover and then even more under FDR. And when Hoover left office, there's a lot of debate about this. But when he left, the Congress the last 2 years was a Democratic Congress. And they're criticized oftentimes by people from the right as having held up a lot of the legislation that Hoover actually wanted to have enacted, which was stimulus-oriented. So I would say, yes, you're right. And then, of course, spending increased even more dramatically under FDR.
Hmm. Interesting. Thanks very much for the call. We go next to Joe from Fayette, Iowa. Hi, Joe.
Yes. Being interested in the Midwest history and the Iowa history, particularly at this point, too. Not only was Herbert Hoover from Iowa, but his wife, Lou Henry, was from Iowa, born in Waterloo, only about 80 miles from West Branch where he was born. And I wonder if you refresh us. I'm trying to remember how it was. She got to California as well, and they ended up in the geology class together at Stanford. He went to visit, he was orphaned, but I think she was from much better off background. I was also going to mention, by the Waterloo has for some years had a Hoover Junior High and has recently dedicated a Lou Henry Elementary School immediately adjacent to it.
Hmm. Tracy, you want to take that one?
I know that she was from a better off background and that her father was incredibly supportive of her as a engineer and outdoor pursuits. I don't recall exactly how she got to from Iowa to California, but that was the first time that they had ever met when they were actually in school together. And one of the regrets that I have about such a limited time, a one-hour documentary, is that we weren't able to include more on Lou Henry Hoover because she was a fascinating woman and a very, very accomplished woman in her own right.
Mm-hmm. As you said, I think, Chip, you needed three documentaries for the years before the presidency, and post-presidency.
Yeah, it's one of the problems with public television, or challenges anyway, is that funding is such a significant issue. And we just didn't have the financial resources to do 3 hours. But I really think Hoover, I hope someday somebody does and they do a three-hour film on Hoover. He's that interesting and that commanding of a figure.
Yeah, and the times were as well in which he lived.
The times were like today. Yeah. Extraordinary.
Thanks, Joe, for your call. We go next to Robert from Fitchburg. Hello, Robert.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
I was calling to join. I grew up in a household where both of my grandparents' families were ruined by Hoover's response to the Depression. Consequently, in my lexicon of evil people, he's right up there at the top of the list. And I think it's admirable that here in the beginning of the 21st century, you're trying to put a new spin on him. It would seem like that he and the last Bush should be in the same pot. And I think that it's got a really, I hope your program, I might listen to it. I might be big enough to listen to it. You points out just the evil this man perpetrated in the name of individualism.
Hmm.
So I'm really, really still hurt by that guy being the president here, although it's 90 years later, because I can be really upset about the agony that my grandparents and consequently my parents had to endure as a consequence of this guy being president.
Hmm.
Even if he was a good guy, so what?
Tracy, you want to start?
Well, I think that that response at the time was certainly very common, and I think one of Hoover's biggest mistakes going in his initial reaction to the Depression and the stock market crash, according to Amity Schles, one of our interview subjects, he thought we were in a period of inflation and we were actually in a period of deflation. So he pulled all this money out of the system. He raised taxes, he tightened interest rates, and homeowners and small businessmen couldn't get the money they needed. Banks were failing. Whole communities were wiped out. When the bank failed, there was no deposit insurance. So if your bank failed, you lost everything. You know, this was incredible suffering, and people were left to, there was no money in the system, and people were left to barter for goods with each other or to use scrip because there was just so much poverty. We can't even imagine it today in this recession, exactly how bad it was then. So I can understand some of that feeling towards Hoover.
Mm-hmm. Chip.
Well, I would agree. I think Robert's point is well taken. In my family, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and we were still suffering a lot of the repercussions of the Great Depression. Whether Hoover was evil or you know, I can't really comment on that perception. His career up to the point he was president appears to be one of great humanitarian work and great sense of humanity, but I would guess that he was just about as over his head as anybody could have been. The question is, now we have institutions in place and we have a whole different understanding of economic policy than we did then. So we're still dealing, though, with many of the same issues,
mm-hmm.
you know, foreclosures, unemployment. The number of people today who are suffering is phenomenal. And are we out of it? Who knows?
Yeah. And I guess it's Reich again who makes the point, imagine living through that time without any backup. There's no backup. There's no unemployment insurance. You know, there's no insurance on your deposit at the bank. When you lose it, you've lost it.
Well, that is what happened. I mean, when people lost it, they lost everything. And there was no Medicare. There were most of the institutions that were put in place by FDR and have carried forward to this day, Social Security, et cetera, that's why they exist. Now, what would Hoover have done in a second term? Who knows? What would he have done if he'd had a Republican Congress? Who knows? But I think clearly where the issue is around his presidency, a lot of people like Robert's ancestors suffered through incredible hardship.
Yeah. You know, I guess the thing that still puzzles me after seeing the documentary and becoming interested in Hoover Now Tracy is this what is it? It's kind of an obliviousness he has to suffering. And yet, on the other hand, he's very in tune with suffering because he's helped people in Belgium pretty much single-handedly. What I don't understand what happened to him. Is it power that can greatly insulate somebody from seeing what's going on? I still don't quite get that.
I can't say that I get it either. You know, the reports were, again, that he really believed that Americans could reach out and help each other and that that was the best way. He didn't want to create a welfare state. While he was okay with having Europeans on the dole and having Europeans accept charity from a private or government organization, he didn't want that to happen in America. But yet people were starving, and he just didn't see it. And it may be in part because as soon as this started happening, I mean, he rolled up his sleeves and he went to work and he became so focused that the impression that I get from the interview subjects that we spoke to is that he was so focused on the problem, he wasn't looking out at what was really happening in the country. He was so focused on trying to solve it and working 14, 15, 16 hours a day trying to solve it.
Yeah. Let's pause for a moment. We'll return. This is the Ideas Network. Tonight on PBS, a portrait of President Herbert Hoover, and it's a documentary titled Landslide, as Chip Duncan, the writer, director, and one of the producers, has said, because of his landslide victory and his landslide defeat. It is directed, written by Chip from the Duncan Group, and also produced by Chip and Tracy Dorsey. Tracy is joining us by phone today from New York. We're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. Let's go next to John from Appleton. Hi, John.
Yes, the people who are, you know, interested in Hoover, and he is actually, you know, I'm a liberal Democrat, but I find him fascinating. Okay. And in fact, actually went over to Iowa back during they had this little election thing back there a year and a half ago or so.
Yeah, they sure did.
And it ended up in Iowa City, which is right by West Branch.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a very nice museum there, which we went through, and it you know, covered the different stages in Hoover's life. And, you know, that's not far for Wisconsin people, and I would definitely recommend it. But to get to this, you know, like, what happened? How do you explain him not reacting to the suffering in the Great Depression when he had been such a humanitarian, as you say, the great humanitarian? And I guess the impression I got from going, you know, spending some time in that museum was that his humanitarian work was on one model, which is you have a problem in one area and you can go somewhere else. And I mean, he collected money in South America to help the people in Belgium, for example. And and you solve the problem that way. But the Depression was worldwide. So there wasn't someplace else to go to get the money. And besides, it, as the president of the United States, it would have been embarrassing to go someplace else to get the money to help Americans. And that you know, his whole humanitarian history kind of got in the way of, I mean, that model just did not apply to the Great Depression as far as solving that problem.
Tracy.
Well, I think that he did recognize that the Depression, in his view, was a global phenomenon. I don't know that he would have reached out for international support to feed America. But, I mean, the humanitarian efforts that he enacted were on a vast scale, especially after World War II, for example. He went back out and was fed the world again and was credited for saving millions and millions and millions of lives through his efforts around the globe after World War II.
You know, borrowing has changed today enormously, and so printing money has changed enormously. The way we pass debt on to the future has changed significantly. So a lot of those things that we do today to solve a short-term economic problem or even a longer-term one like the one we're in now are things that wouldn't have been considered in 1930, 32. They just, you know, the idea of putting your future in jeopardy by going into debt was a very different idea then.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. We go next to Tom from Westby. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. 2 points. First of all, I had the opportunity back in the 80s and 90s to teach in Des Moines, Iowa for 10 years at Herbert Hoover High School.
Hmm.
And other than a bust of Hoover in the lobby, there was not much taught about him. I taught a unique leadership program, and every other year I took my students to the museum that we've talked about, and it is absolutely wonderful, and the students really had an eye-opening. The question that I have, though, and the comment is, I'd like the author's opinions about the effect that might have been involved because of concern about the recent Russian Revolution, socialism. There was a fear of socialism in Europe and in our country, and what part might that have played?
Well, first of all, Tom, I just want to mention that I'm a landowner near you, and I love that part of the state. Westby is just beautiful. In terms of the issues that you're talking about, it was certainly a huge issue during the Wilson administration, the whole idea of the Bolsheviks and what was happening. Now, I'm not an expert on this particular subject, but I will say that Hoover, even during his presidency, was still making efforts to feed people around the world, including Russians. So you're getting into kind of a major movement from, you know, roughly the late teens into the period of World War II. But I actually don't know the answer to that question.
What I can say, and my knowledge is limited, but that Hoover, when he wrote his pamphlet, American Individualism, it was written by a man who had traveled and lived all around the world, including Russia. And he was determined that America would not fall into the same traps that Russia had, or even England with their class society. He was adamantly against any kind of class strata. So when he wrote American Individualism, it was in praise of America's unique civil society and the unique role of civil society in our political philosophy, not just of government.
Hmm. Was he a greedy guy?
Not at all. I think that in terms of his Quaker background, he had learned the value of community support and helping neighbors. And even in 1914, when he was called on to help Americans get out of London, he was already looking for a way to start giving back. He was just around 40 years old at the time and had become dissatisfied with his business life and was looking for a way that he could start giving back to society and to communities.
You know, it's interesting. I actually have pulled a quote really quick that I've always liked is Hoover was talking – it's in Kennedy's book on Hoover, and he said, you know, the only trouble with capitalism is capitalists, they're too damn greedy. And actually, Hoover eventually got back a few years after leaving office, eventually came back into public service, and in 1964, shortly before he died, he had backed Goldwater, who could have – made that same quote. I mean, Goldwater saw the limits of capitalism in a way that I think Hoover did as well.
And he lived a long time, didn't he? He didn't die till 64.
90 years old.
Yeah. 90 years old. Mm-hmm.
He outlived his wife by about 20 years.
So. Wow. What did he eat? Do you know?
Organic food from Westby.
Maybe. So the show is on tonight.
It
at 9 o'clock.
Yep, 10 Eastern, 9 Central, which I presume would be 9 Mountain and 10 West Coast time. So wherever you're listening, please tune in.
Okay, and who's next on your presidential list?
Well, we've been developing a film about Ronald Reagan, a portrait on Reagan for public television. So with any luck, we'll have it on the air in November of 2011, which is the 100th anniversary of Reagan's birth. And the
is it really?
Yeah,
oh, my gosh.
And the 30th anniversary of his inauguration. So.
Whew. That's something. Thank you very much, Chip, for being with us. And thank you, Tracy, for being here as well. It's a portrait of President Herbert Hoover. It's titled Landslide. Again, it's on tonight on PBS. Check your local listings, as they say, to find out exactly where it is in your part of the Midwest or beyond. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all your sparkling questions, as always. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn. News is ahead. It's a minute before 11, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.